Court appointed is meant to be for entertainment purposes and basic legal information only.
Nothing in this podcast should be considered as legal representation nor legal advice.
Only use the knowledge presented herein to dazzle your friends or possibly win bar trivia.
Perspective on legal frivolity. I'm your co-host, Mike Meadows. I'm a lawyer and a dude.
And I'm your other co-host, Tommy Smurl. And I am just a dude.
Well, Tommy, I was reading the paper the other day, and I realized that there was a serial killer that was somewhat in our midst.
Yeah, if I did know about it, I'd forgotten about it. I didn't know this guy was from here.
I had no idea either. I didn't know that there was any kind of claim to shame.
Infamy
about this guy. But his name is Bobby Joe Long. And I always wondered, whenever you have serial killers and people who are like try to assassinate presidents and things like that, it's always three names. They always have like, you know, first,
John
middle,
Wayne
last.
Gacy.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, David Berkowitz.
He probably had a middle name too. Lee Harvey Oswald.
Yeah, that's true. Maybe they like to hang him on there like that.
I don't know. It's just
John Wilkes Booth.
Yeah, it's just one of those things that you always notice. They always have the middle name.
Well, besides the catchy nickname that the press gives you when you're a serial killer, they all hang these catchy nicknames on all the serial killers.
Oh, that's true. They do.
So they're known by that.
Yeah.
So, but
Jeffrey Eat Me Dahmer.
I don't think that's quite what he was.
Oh.
He was a cannibal.
Oh. Jeffrey Eat You Dahmer?
Yeah, Eat You. But but yes, Bobby Joe Long was a serial killer that was arrested down in Florida. But he was from Canova, West Virginia, which is a little town, bumps right up against Huntington, where we live here in West Virginia.
Yeah, it's like, kind of like...
It's like about 4 miles past my office.
Real, real West Huntington.
Yeah. Yeah, it's down where Camden Park is.
It is. And I actually was the public defender for the city of Canova there for a little bit in their municipal court.
Yeah.
So that was where I had all my night court experience.
But I guess we're glad this guy moved away from here. When he did, he moved away at a young age, and I guess we're glad he did.
I'd say so. Although it seems like from reading his story, he kind of moved back and forth a few times.
Yeah, his parents divorced.
Yeah.
And so he moved back and forth between West Virginia and Florida. So but most of your headlines, what are they? Florida man.
Yeah, he's definitely a Florida
so
man.
So there's got to be some kind of influence once you go down there. You don't read that many West Virginia man. We keep those private up here.
So we're going to talk about this serial killer a little bit. And so we're probably not going to be too graphic about the crimes. But I just want to give you a warning ahead of time just in case. Because we do discuss the crimes, but that's really not the point of this episode. We're going to talk a bit about the kind of the procedural stuff that happened with this case. It was kind of interesting.
That's right, but there is rape and murder involved.
Yeah, as usually happens with serial killers.
Yes, they're not very nice people there normally.
Well, here's the interesting thing, too. We're recording this on Thursday, May 23rd, and it's almost 6 p.m., and he's scheduled to be executed Thursday, May 23rd at 6 p.m.
Yeah, we'll find out tomorrow if it went through. But that's what brought it to light. That's what put it back in the news, is that he was the first person to be executed in Florida in like 10 years or something, wasn't it?
I think so, yeah.
Something like that. So that's what they had a big write-up about the case and everything.
Basically, he filed I forget the name of it, because this really wasn't what we were researching, but I looked it up. And I guess there's maybe some sort of last-ditch kind of Florida thing they do where they have to go through and determine if it's right for the person to be executed, and that was decided back in April. And as a result of that, the governor signed his death warrant, is what they call it. And since the governor signed that death warrant back in April, he's been filing all kinds of different motions and things like that, and appeals and different things like that. And the one actually was just, I found online, it actually just came out, I think, yesterday. It was his final one, basically saying, denying all of his relief requested. So I think he probably is going to be executed here in the coming moments as we record this.
Well, one of them
that, and I shouldn't laugh about that. That was kind of a nervous laugh to, yeah, you know.
Well, one of them that always comes up that I always find amusing is that they say that the death by injection should not be allowed because it's cruel and inhumane.
Well, and that was his final argument, because there's three different shots that they give, and they went into the different names of the chemicals in it, and basically saying the first one is known to cause pain and this, that, and the other. And that was what he was trying to argue, too, this, in this final last-ditch effort. But, again, they said that one of the things that was that he didn't actually raise that argument timely because he knew what the method was going to be a year ago.
Right.
And he only just recently, a month ago, filed all this stuff about cruel and unusual punishment. So that was kind of the basis for that.
The reason I think it's ridiculous is because that's cruel and inhumane. Well, what about what you did to those people that you murdered? You know, you didn't think about cruel and inhumane then. You know, there's a little taste of your own medicine.
Well, that's true.
It's karma, baby.
But there's a difference between a criminal doing it and state-sanctioned cruel and unusual. So we don't like state-sanctioned cruel and unusual.
Well, it's kind not of on purpose. It's just a function of the.
It's thing. It's kind of unconstitutional.
Yeah. You know, that last-ditch effort they have down in Florida, the way that works is they take you to a Denny's, and if you can eat 10 Denny's Grand Slams in 20 minutes, then they let you off death row. Nobody's escaped death row yet.
I like Moons Over Miami, just for the simple pun of that. So, this Bobby Joe Long, like I said, well, they also had an interesting thing. They had a quote in there from our police chief, Hank Dial. And he said that he didn't know of any unsolved mysteries that were possibly linked to this guy.
Right.
So it doesn't seem like, even though he was a fairly prolific serial killer in Florida and also possibly California.
Right.
It doesn't look like he actually committed any crimes here in West Virginia, at least that we know of.
Not that we know of.
So, but he could. We don't know.
That's right.
I'll kind of get to I'll start off basically about how he was caught. So we want to go to November 6, 1984. Two women discovered a young woman's skeletonized remains in a horse pasture in rural Pasco County. And Pasco County is near Tampa, Florida.
Mm-hmm.
And it's kind of important to realize this is in Pasco County because this kind of comes into play with what we're going to talk about. Now, the remains were those of Virginia Johnson, and she was a prostitute who had been reported missing for about a month. The medical examiner concluded that basically she had been strangled, possibly from a shoestring found around her neck, or possibly by somebody's hands, manual strangulation. So, also in November, in Tampa and Hillsborough County, law enforcement officials had basically had a report from someone named Lisa McVeigh, and she said that she had been abducted from her apartment and sexually assaulted. Officers were given a bolo for a white male, approximately 30 years old, medium build, slightly pudgy, conservatively cut brown hair, and a mustache. And about that same time, the police officers in Tampa and Hillsborough had also assembled some sort of special task force because they had seen kind of a series of unsolved homicides that looked pretty similar. So they were kind of noticing that these were going on.
They were suspecting that this was happening, serial killer.
And do you know what BOLO stands for?
By of law officer.
No.
Best I could do.
You better think about it because it might come back up later.
Oh, well, I need to know what it is then.
I can't help you.
Well, you have to tell me. I don't have to figure these things out on my own.
Be on the lookout.
Oh, be on the lookout.
Yeah.
So it used to be an APB.
All Points Bulletin.
Yeah, see, I knew that one. I'm used to that.
And BOLO stands for be on the lookout.
Be on the lookout. That's a cheap way of an APB. You got to change everything.
Now, the suspect was believed to have been driving a red Dodge Magnum with white interior, the word Magnum, and a digital watch located on the glove box door. And on November 15th, two detectives spotted a vehicle and subject fitting the description. So, pretty much not long after Lisa McVeigh had given this description.
As Lisa McVeigh, she actually survived his, was the only one, I guess, that survived him abducting her to rape her and kill her. And he kept her for like a total of 26 hours, took her back to his own house and subjected her to, you know, torture and rape and everything. But somehow she talked him into, she was only 17 years old, and she talked him into letting her go. And so he blindfolded her, like I say, 26 hours later and drove her back to her house and dropped her off.
Yeah.
So, I mean,
that's
extremely bizarre. You don't ever hear about that kind of thing.
No. And there's actually a movie that came out, I think, a year ago. It was kind of one of those Hallmark-type movies where it was mm-hmm. her story and things like that. And it's kind of well-known story on these different crime shows that she's the one who actually was able to talk the serial right. killer into letting her go.
So. Yeah, usually if you have something like that, they survived it, but they escaped him
yeah.
and got away and then reported it. You don't have any where the serial killer said, no, okay, I'm going to give you a break.
And this guy's, his modus operandi, what he usually did was he would go through different classified ads or different kinds of ads that were in the paper, and he would go to show up to say, look at a couch, and if the woman was there by herself, that's when he would typically
decide she's a victim.
Yeah, she's going to be a victim. So he was kind of he used the papers and the classifieds as basically his tool to try to help.
He was an opportunist.
Yeah.
He would find that to have an excuse to be in their house. And then if they made the mistake of being there alone, then he was ready to act.
Yeah. Now, the.
So they called him the classified ad rapist or the classified ad killer, depending on which crime you're looking at.
So after this bolo was out, which we know what that means now, they stopped the suspect.
Be on the lookout.
And they saw different things in the interior, which confirmed their suspicion that it was him, the watch, and the things like that. And the driver identified himself as Robert Long. So rather than arrest him right there, what they did is they photographed the automobile and released him and notified the superiors. And then based upon an affidavit with the above information, they obtained an arrest warrant for him and a search warrant for his apartment and car. And they found hair and fiber evidence, which basically linked to the similar analysis of Lisa McVeigh's clothing and also to some other crimes that had taken place, too. So mm-hmm. really what they did is they kind of, I guess, smartly maybe, went and got a warrant ahead of time for his house and everything like that. Like, basically, they didn't want to spook him or anything like that. Right. And they really didn't think they had, I guess, maybe great grounds for a warrant at that time. I don't know why they did it that way. I guess they...
Well, maybe also because they came across him so quickly, too.
Yeah.
Right after that happened. And so they didn't have everybody completely understanding what was happening maybe yet or something. So
yeah.
they took these extra precautions just to make sure.
So the next day they arrested him, and the warrant was for abduction, kidnapping, and sexual battery of Lisa McVeigh, the 17-year-old that got away. And after his arrest, they transport him to the Hillsborough County Sheriff's Office for questioning. And the detectives there, what they did is they read a long-form Miranda waiver. And he reviewed it and signed it. So basically the Miranda rights, we know, are the, you know, you have the right to attorney, you have the right to remain silent, all that. And what they did is they memorialized this in an actual written waiver. And they had him read it and said, if you understand this, sign it. Which, that's a great way to do it because... then there's no confusion about, well, they didn't read me my Miranda rights, or they did. Mm-hmm. Like, here's your signed version. We know you did.
And there was something else in there, too, where they got him to say that he was willing to talk to him, right?
Well,
I mean,
yeah.
I mean, because a Miranda doesn't say, I agree to talk to you. It just says, I understand I have the
right
to not talk to you if I don't want to.
Yeah, exactly. And the interesting thing about the Miranda warning is it comes actually from the Fifth Amendment. Basically, the Fifth Amendment right to counsel was recognized in the Miranda v. Arizona ruling. And that basically makes sure that a person is under that they understand their rights, they know they have the right to remain silent, and they have the right to an attorney. And basically this starts attaching whenever there's what's called a custodial interrogation. So if an individual is not warned of their Miranda rights during this custodial interrogation, and then they subsequently give some sort of confession or things like that, then it can be thrown out. So they need not actually be formally arrested before the Miranda warnings. It's basically, it doesn't depend on the arrest. It depends on the custodial interrogation is what that turns on. Mm-hmm. So he was actually under arrest, though, because they had an arrest warrant for him.
Right.
So regardless, I mean, an arrest can be a custodial interrogation, but it didn't matter.
He was not just a person of interest.
He wasn't free to leave.
Right.
let's put it that way. So anyway, he did this waiver, and they basically said, hey, we want to ask you some questions about some things. And he basically went on to talk to him, and for the next hour and a half, he answered questions, cooperated with him, and he basically gave them a full confession for the Lisa McVeigh case. You know, he essentially probably figured, hey, they must have me on this. I screwed up. I let her go. you know, hindsight's 20/20. I should not have let her go, but
so I better go ahead and admit to this,
right?
So they don't start prodding around and looking for the other things because he had already killed 10 other women.
That's right. And one of the detectives left the room at that point, and they went to get some snapshot photographs of some of the other murder victims that they thought this guy would had something to do with because of the way it all went down with Lisa McVeigh. And so he comes back, and the detective asks him if he ever picked up prostitutes in the area. And he said, I would prefer not to answer that.
Mm-hmm.
So at this point, he starts kind of clamming up a little bit. And
a simple yes or no will suffice.
Yeah. So the detective started showing the different photographs, and his attitude changed at that point. And he remarked to the detective, this is a direct quote, "The complexion of things have sure changed since you came back into the room. I think I might need an attorney."
Yeah, he suddenly decided that they weren't as dumb as he was hoping they were.
Yeah, and he seems like a pretty articulate kind of guy, too. And so basically, it's pretty clear that the officers continued on their interrogation. And as a result of that, he ended up giving a confession. So, and here's a little...
He confessed to 8 of the murders.
Yeah, here's a little excerpt from it. This is from the suppression hearing whenever they tried to basically exclude...
His confession.
Mm-hmm. The question is, okay, after Mr. Long... This is the attorney asking the officer the questions here. Okay, after Mr. Long said he'd rather not answer the question about the Tampa prostitutes, after you showed him pictures of some prostitutes in Tampa, some maybe not prostitutes in Tampa, do you recall at that point Mr. Long saying, I think I need an attorney? Yes, sir. Were those his exact words, as you recall? No, they weren't his exact words. Best of my recollection, his exact words, he looked at myself, made the statement, the complexion of things sure has changed since you came back into the room. And he continued by saying, I think I might need an attorney. Complexion of things have changed, hadn't they? Answer is, yes, sir. You told him they haven't. No. I said, nothing has changed. I'm still being honest with you. Were you being honest with him, in fact? The officer said, nothing had changed for me. I was pursuing the interrogation. So, you know, there's nothing in there that says the police officers are going to be honest with him. Right. They're interrogating.
Yeah.
So.
But it seems to me that, I mean, even if he signed this waiver, that once he said, I want an attorney, that they should have stopped questioning him. And I would think that a good attorney would have come along and said, you know, we've got grounds for a mistrial here or whatever. That evidence should not have been allowed.
Yeah. Well, procedurally, I'm going to get into it. But before that, I think we have a possible motion before the court.
Yes, if it please the court, we have a return customer that we would very much like our listeners to patronize.
And who's that?
It is BetterHelp at BetterHelp.com.
Is there something interfering with your happiness or is preventing you from achieving your goals?
BetterHelp will assess your needs and match you with your own licensed professional therapist.
You can start communicating with someone in under 24 hours.
Under 24 hours?
That's right.
You can't even get an appointment calling on the phone anywhere in that kind of time.
You can't, and sometimes you just need somebody to talk to.
That's right. Now, this is not a crisis line. It's not self-help. It is professional counseling done securely online.
There's a broad range of expertise in BetterHelp's counselor network, which may not be locally available in many areas. Like we said before, here in rural West Virginia, you're going to have trouble finding a counselor sometimes.
That's right. And they're only a few clicks away with BetterHelp.com. This service is available for clients worldwide. You can log into your account anytime and send a message to your counselor.
And you'll get a timely and thoughtful response. Plus, you can schedule weekly video or phone sessions so you won't ever have to sit in an uncomfortable waiting room.
I hate waiting rooms. The magazines are always out of date.
I know. They're super old. Did you know that Princess Diana passed away?
What? BetterHelp is committed to facilitating great therapeutic matches so they make it easy and free to change counselors if needed.
It's more affordable than traditional offline counseling, and financial aid is available.
So, if you are interested in this, you need to visit BetterHelp.com/court and join the over 500,000 people taking charge of their mental health with the help of an experienced professional.
Court-appointed listeners get 10% off your first month at BetterHelp.com/court.
So, BetterHelp and court-appointed, two things to help you out.
There you go. Now, you keep harping on the fact that, well, it doesn't seem like this confession should have come in. Some attorney should have done something. Why didn't they do anything? Why did this come in? Why was he convicted? It doesn't seem right.
Well, I mean, let me get something straight. I'm not rooting for the dude. No. I mean, he's clearly guilty, but the thing is there's a lot of guilty people that get off on technicalities and stuff like that, well, but it just seems like this was done wrong.
And let me tell you, even though this is how I think an attorney generally views it, with these technicalities on somebody who you know is guilty. The thing is that if we have a breakdown of the technicalities and we don't follow the rule of law for people we know are guilty, then it could expose somebody who is actually innocent to not actually get due process. So it is very important for attorneys to make sure that everything is followed properly. And if it's not, as an attorney, it's your job to try to push the envelope in every single technicality, loophole, whatever you want to call it, you can, because that's what you have to do.
Well, I understand. That's also why it's important that police and prosecutors do their job correctly so that there are no technicalities to taint the evidence.
Yeah, but you mean, think about the heat of the moment. And I'm just putting myself in these police officers' shoes. They have this guy. He's already confessed to the
kidnapping rape, and rape of that girl.
Of her. Mm-hmm. They basically know that he's the one that's doing these other things.
Mm-hmm.
So they start questioning about it. He says he doesn't want to talk about it. He's being a little, not really saying, I'm not going to talk to you anymore. I want an attorney now. He's not exactly saying that, but he's kind of skirting around it and hinting around it.
Mm-hmm.
You have a choice. Do you stop the interrogation, stop trying to get the facts straight so you can lock this guy away? Or do you kind of push it a little bit because he's kind of hemming and hawing a little bit with not being real specific about what he says?
Well, what I've learned from this podcast, when in doubt, get the search warrant. When in doubt, stop the interview and get the correct people in there before you proceed, because it's going to be a lot worse later on when you have to throw this stuff out, and that's what your whole case centered on.
Yeah. Well, they decided to press on and keep talking to him about it. And after that exchange that I was telling you about, that from the excerpt from the suppression hearing, he basically made a full confession of Virginia Johnson's murder. Now, Virginia Johnson was the one who was killed in Pasco County.
Right.
So we're in Hillsborough County now. He's the Hillsborough County, some police agency in Hillsborough County.
Right.
And so he confessed to a murder in Pasco County with Virginia Johnson. And so basically that was the first case that went to trial, was Virginia Johnson one.
Mm-hmm.
So now the attorney for, what's his name? Bobby Joe
Long.
Bobby Joe Jimmy something or another. Anyway, his attorney did file a motion to suppress. And his attorney did raise these issues, that basically saying that, hey, you should have stopped interrogating. This confession about Virginia Johnson's murder is not allowed. He asked for an attorney. You kept on talking to him. You should have broken off any kind of questioning at that point. But basically, the judge said, no, you know what? I'm going to go ahead and allow it. I think it was fine what they did. So the judge said, I'm not going to throw it out. I think it was a fine confession.
But there are higher judges that could also review that and find differently.
Well, there are. And so here's what happened. And this is where it gets really kind of interesting about this case.
Mm-hmm.
So he basically is convicted in Pasco County for Virginia Johnson's murder. Now, whenever you have cases like this, you have what's called a bifurcated trial. So you have the guilt phase, where they determine whether or not he's guilty, and then the penalty phase, which determines what the penalty shall be.
Right.
During the guilt phase, like I said, the jury decides the guilt or innocence. If they're found guilty, the trial moves to the penalty phase, where a jury receives additional kind of information about whether or not the person should be executed in this situation, since it's a death penalty case. So the jury recommended the death penalty for him with regards to this case for Virginia Johnson. Yes, Virginia Johnson. So, meanwhile, while he's been convicted of that case and sentenced to death for that, they appeal that. He goes over to Hillsborough County now, and I think it's he's got seven more. It's either seven or eight. Seven more murders he's being charged with there. And so, what he does is, he enters into a plea deal in Hillsborough County for those other murders. And the plea deal he enters into is basically that he will plead guilty to all of those murders.
As long as he doesn't get the death penalty.
As long as he doesn't get the death penalty for 7 of them.
Mm-hmm.
But now the one, he might get the death penalty for, but he gets to argue for that one.
Right.
And he basically said, I'm not going to challenge the confessions in these cases. I'll go ahead and take my guilt. And so he got sentenced to...
like 7 life sentences.
Life sentence, yeah, for those 7. And then he actually got sentenced to the death penalty for the one he did. So they, during the guilt phase, they basically went ahead and sentenced him to death for that. Now, in the meantime, his appeal in Pasco County is still pending. So the appellate court there basically said, you know what? We think the judge in the Pasco County case got it wrong. That should not have been allowed. So you're going to have a new trial. So the whole reason he took the plea in the Hillsborough County case was, mm-hmm. was to try to limit his exposure, knowing he had already been sentenced in Pasco County.
Right.
So basically, he's getting a new trial now in Pasco County. He's already pled guilty to these other crimes and sentenced here in Hillsborough County. And he was trying to, like I said, he was trying to limit his exposure. So he's fighting a battle on kind of 2 different fronts here. In Hillsborough County, he's got the plea thing worked out, but now he wants to take his plea away because he's thinking, you know what? They already said these convictions couldn't come in, so I want to withdraw my plea and try to do something differently. But he's got a problem because once you enter a plea, you can't take it back without good reason.
Right.
So
I changed my mind.
So in the meantime, he starts appealing the Hillsborough County cases, right?
Mm-hmm.
Well, they say, all right, we're gonna try you up again here in Pasco County. And so they try him again in Pasco County. And in Pasco County, there's something called Williams Rule Evidence in Florida, which is very similar to, is the same thing as 404B evidence everywhere else. It's just called Williams Rule Evidence. And basically, it's evidence which is used to show the defendant used the same motive, intent, knowledge, modus operandi, or mistake in a case.
Right.
So the state attorney in Pasco County says, I'm going to try to get in these other crimes he's already pled guilty to in Hillsborough County now to obtain a conviction in the Pasco County case. I don't need the confession now.
Because he's already admitted guilt.
Because he already admitted guilt. And his other 7, they're showing that basically this is what he usually did to try to kill people. He would, you know, pick up prostitutes.
Right.
Use the ads, whatever.
Yeah, and they said that besides the 10 people he murdered and the one girl he let go, that he was probably responsible for quite a few more rapes.
Yeah.
Like as many as like 80.
Yeah. And so basically what they did is they used these other cases from Hillsborough County as to help prove his guilt in Pasco County. And during the, I said, you know, these are bifurcated hearings. Well, other crimes come in during bifurcated hearings,
mm-hmm.
Regardless of whether or not it's 404B or not, because that's what the during the penalty phase, they look at that to make a determination about what your proper penalty should be. So he had all these other murders that he basically pled to in Pasco County. So of
that
course,
matched the one over there.
Yeah, so of course they recommend the death penalty over there too.
Mm-hmm.
So it didn't really matter. It didn't matter what this guy was doing because he was in 2 different counties. They had him coming and going.
He made big tactical error.
Oh.
He should never try to be a chess champion.
Oh, I mean, when I was going through this case and looking at it, I was thinking, oh my gosh, they played this guy like a fiddle. Because what they did is, I mean, if you think about it procedurally, even if you knew that the confession would get overturned on appeal, by securing that one and then convincing him to plead to the other, because it's, what does it matter?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it was back and forth. I mean, he was like, what are those Chinese finger cuffs?
Yeah.
I mean, the tighter he tried to pull away, the tighter it got, so...
But he was very prolific for the short amount of time, and this is what makes it unsure, because he was in California sometime too. But when this finally came to a head, it happened between March 27th of 1984 and November 11th of 1984.
Yeah.
10 murders and then the abduction where he let the girl go. So that was 11 people. That it was all just in that short period of time that he did that. And like I say, there was a bunch of other rapes in the area that happened too, that they never even bothered going to trial because he was already had all the life sentences and the death penalty. So what difference did it make?
Yeah.
But they felt that he was responsible for it. But there were also some activity in California, which they didn't bother trying to extradite him for or anything like that. Yeah. But they felt that he committed those crimes there as well.
Well, I think it matched up with regards to, there was some evidence they had. It might even been like DNA type evidence or something. It was pretty, right. They were certain that this was the guy, basically.
But you can only kill him so many times.
Yeah, and
so it didn't make any difference.
I mean, you know, he's going to kill him once, kill him twice. Yeah. I don't know. But so basically, I thought it was kind of interesting because, you know, you kept saying, well, you know, why didn't the attorney do this? Well, the attorney did file a motion to suppress, but the judge just didn't care.
Matter after that.
Yeah. That reminds me of a story. There was an older attorney down in Florida I knew, and he had a client, and evidently the judge hated his client. I mean, just disliked this guy. Mm-hmm. And he had been found guilty at trial, I think, and it was up to the judge to sentence him. And the judge says, well, I'm going to give you 20 years in prison. And he turns to the judge. I'm going to object to that sentence. I mean, the maximum sentence for this is like, you know, 10 years. He said, well, I understand that. You can take it up on appeal. I'm giving him 20. And so basically, he said that they appealed it and it went up to the appellate court, who basically said, yeah, that's an illegal sentence. We're going to vacate that sentence and send him back down with instructions to be sentenced to 10 years. And the judge, same judge, went back to him again, pulled him up, said, all right, I'm going to sentence you to 20 years. Didn't care what the appellate court said. So, I mean, you know, judges can do kind of whatever they want. I mean, the worst thing that's going to happen is they're going to get reversed on appeal. But if, you know, they don't care about it, they might not care so much. And that might have been the case with regards to this suppression hearing. Is, I mean, it seemed pretty clear to me that this was probably a wrong confession. Mm-hmm. But the judge may have said, I don't really care.
Doesn't matter.
I'm going to let it in.
Well, that's what I say. It's not like I was rooting for the dude. It's just a lot of things that we've seen that would have been a tainted confession. But I mean, he was guilty though.
Yeah.
Even if it was tainted, he was guilty.
And as an attorney in a situation like that, all you can basically do is you want to make your appellate record. You want to make sure you make all your objections, file all your motions, things like that. Just so that way, when you do have an opportunity, you can go up on appeal and you can argue these things, these errors.
Well, part of the thing that he tried to do to defend himself was say that he wasn't responsible for a lot of his actions. Said that, first of all, he was born with an extra X chromosome. So as he reached puberty, he started growing breasts, which, of course, exposed him to extreme teasing and ridicule from other people, and that he was suffered several severe beatings and injuries to his head as a result of that.
He additionally had said he had a motorcycle accident too at some point.
Well, when he was in the military, when he was 20 years old, he wrecked on a motorcycle and had a brain injury from that, supposedly. And mm-hmm. his wife, he was married from 74 to 80 and had two kids. But his wife said that after that motorcycle wreck, she noticed severe change in his being, how he was and how he acted, his personality. But said another thing, too, he had a dysfunctional relationship with his mother, as she made him sleep in bed with her until he was a teenager, and he resented her multiple short-term boyfriends.
Yeah, I mean, that's a little strange.
So between the head injuries and the breasts and the mother making him sleep in bed with her there, he felt that he was traumatized. That's what led to a lot of these things. And I thought it was interesting. He was divorced in 1980, and all these murders and rapes started taking place shortly thereafter.
Well, I think some of them may have even taken place while he was still married, didn't they?
Well, not that they showed listed on here.
Okay.
Not that he was actually convicted of. All the ones he was convicted of were in that short time span between March and November of 84.
Yeah.
All the ones that happened were in there. And then when you were talking about some of the things that he did to try to get out of his conviction, get out of the death penalty.
Yeah.
Said that some of the things were he accused the Capital Collateral Regional Council, that's the state office that defends death row inmates and their appeals, of revealing his private letters to a book author, thus violating his attorney-client privilege. He also accused the agency of running a death pool, betting on the dates on which inmates would be executed, and asked that the agency be removed from his case. So it said an investigation concluded that these allegations were unfounded, and Long's petition for a writ of mandamus to require Bob Dillinger, the public defender for the Sixth Judicial Circuit, to relinquish possession and control of his file in State v. Long was denied.
Yeah, a writ of mandamus is an extraordinary writ. And basically what that is where you're essentially asking a court to order some sort of public official to do something. So basically, if there was a some action, like if, for example, say you went to, you had a hearing on a motion, and the judge did not enter an order for that to either grant or deny your motion, and you had waited quite some time for it, and you got really mad at the judge. Not a good idea to do this, but you could do it. You could file a writ of mandamus asking a higher court to force the judge to enter an order in that. So, I mean, that's one way. The other side of that coin is called another extraordinary writ. It's called a writ of prohibition, and that's basically where you're seeking some sort of writ prohibiting some sort of government official from doing something. So you have mandamus trying to force and prohibition prohibiting. Yeah.
But it said that officially that he was sentenced to 1 5-year sentence, 4 99-year sentences, 28 life sentences, and 1 death sentence.
Yeah.
So there's no way he was ever going to get out anyway.
No, I don't think so. I think his time is drawing nigh as this podcast goes on. So, you know, if you think about like the center there in Florida, I forget the regional name for it, you said, if they did have a death pool, it'd be a little morbid. Maybe a little unprofessional.
Well, they've kind of got inside information. That wouldn't be they couldn't bet against the public.
Yeah. You
know? They'd have to bet just amongst themselves as long as they all had the same information.
Yeah, it's a little dark too.
Yeah. Well, they're the ones that handle all the appeals on death row and stuff.
Yeah. But I think it's very important, like I said, when you have these kinds of trials and hearings, to make sure that you really try to explore every kind of avenue you possibly can for your client. Because like I said, I mean, we all know this guy's guilty. I mean, there's no question about it.
Right.
Does he deserve to walk free? No.
No.
But I think justice demands that we make sure that he is afforded every single possible due process argument available to him. And that's always my whole fallback problem with the death penalty in itself is, you know, I don't know. I'm just not a fan of it.
Well, here's the thing. The guy's 66 years old, something like that. He's been in prison 34 years.
He's been on death row for 32.
Yeah, that's what I mean.
Yeah.
It's like, you know, he's been in there over half his life. If he was guilty and they gave him death penalty, he should have been dead a long time ago.
Yeah,
making him sit around there and do that, that's just ridiculous.
I found so much information on this guy from different appeals and hearings and stuff like that. I mean, it was literally everywhere. I watched a oral argument from 1992, I think it was, where an attorney was in front of the Florida Supreme Court arguing about this case. It was on Vimeo. I mean, I couldn't even, I was like, wow, that's
92?
Yeah. It was kind of interesting. I mean, there is so much work that went into this case, so much judicial and financial. I mean, I don't want to say waste because I think you have to do that, but I mean, dear Lord, it's a long time.
Well, one of the things that I thought was interesting is that, you know, they made a point to say about the number of head injuries that he'd gotten.
Right.
And trying to blame his actions on his head injuries.
Right.
So I guess they were saying that they weren't saying he was insane, but they were saying that it had caused brain damage, so he wasn't able to make decisions, or it caused this severe personality disorder or whatever.
And you know from our previous episodes why that is?
No.
Well, I mean, what is the brain control?
Oh, the mens rea.
Right. So if you don't have the
mens rea, then you can't be found guilty.
A first degree.
Right.
Now, I mean, a lot of these things, you're just trying to basically
Minimize
it as much as you can.
Right.
So you're trying to say basically why it shouldn't be first degree, why it shouldn't be open to the death penalty, why it should be second degree or something along those lines. Because you're lacking that extra little bit of mental acumen to say, hey, this should be first degree.
Well, what, you know me, curious minds want to know, I thought, I wonder how many other serial killers tried to use head injuries as a reason for why they were a serial killer.
Mm-hmm.
And I really thought, well, this is just a wasted Google, but it's, you know, what does it cost you? And I was shocked with the answer that I got back. So as I go through, it says, anytime an infamous serial killer's childhood is mentioned, there are always four topics of conversation which are mentioned as possible clues to their terrifying future as a murderer: bedwetting, animal abuse, arson, and of course, Of course, I didn't know this. Sustaining a serious head injury at an early age. Now, I didn't know that was one of the four signs of a serial killer.
Do ants count as animals?
Ants?
Yeah.
No.
Okay, good. Because I was going to be 4 for 4 there, I think.
Oh. Were you a bedwetter?
I don't know. I don't want to talk about it.
Obviously, these aren't the only factors which create a serial killer. The most important one being abuse by a parent, which, according to him, was in there too. And it said whether it was physical, sexual, emotional, or often all three. So anyway, it said that this was focusing on just serial killers that had claimed head injuries as part of their reason. Glenn Edwards Rogers, the cross-country killer. See, here's these nicknames they all have.
Three names.
Says that as a toddler, aged 1 to 2 years old, Rogers would sit and rock back and forth, continually banging his forehead against hard surfaces such as walls, doors, and floors, yet never once cried, as if he had no emotions or feeling. Richard Ramirez, the night stalker.
Oh, yeah.
Age 2, Ramirez sustained a significant injury to his head when a dresser fell on top of him, causing a laceration which required 30 stitches. And aged 5 years old, he was knocked out by a swing in the park. This becomes a repetitious thing, too. Yeah. That must be, you know, swings used to be wooden swings?
Oh, yeah.
You know, wooden planks?
Yeah.
Now there are those strap-looking things. This must be why, when you see all these serial killers that got hit in the head with swings.
Swing sets.
Yes.
We have that to blame for serial killers.
Swing set serial killer. He was knocked out by a swing in the park. This head injury caused him to suffer from epileptic seizures, which remained until he was a teenager. John Wayne Gacy, the killer clown. Catchy nickname. Age 6, Gacy.
From outer space.
That's a good movie.
It is a good
movie. I love that movie. Gacy, as was beaten unconscious by his father wielding a broomstick at age 11. He was struck in the head with a swing, again, which, although not diagnosed until he was 16, resulted in his suffering from blackouts. Fred West, the Gloucester Road Murders. Age 17, West suffered a fractured skull in a motorbike accident, just like Bobby Joe, which left him unconscious for 7 days. 2 years later, age 19, West groped a girl on a fire escape outside the Ledbury Youth Club. She punched him, and he fell 2 floors. Both injuries caused him to black out and frequently suffer from violent rages. David Berkowitz, son of Sam.
Mm-hmm.
1960, 6-year-old David Berkowitz ran into the road outside his childhood home, was struck by a car, and suffered unspecified head injuries, although it is not known if this had any lasting effects. A few months later, he ran into a wall and again suffered from head injuries. At age 8, he was hit on the head with a pipe and received a 4-inch gash. That wouldn't be funny except for the fact these guys are serial killers, so it's all right if we laugh at their poor fortune.
Probably so.
Albert Fish, the Werewolf of Wisteria. Now, that's a good nickname.
Yeah, wow, that's a...
At the age of 7 years old, Fish fell from a cherry tree, which caused severe head trauma, exact injuries unspecified, which caused him to suffer from dizzy spells and severe headaches for the rest of his life. Ed Gain, the Plainfield Butcher. Gain came from an abusive family and would later claim that his violent alcoholic father would beat him about the head so hard my ears would ring. You know who Ed Gain? What movies he inspired?
Is that Leatherface?
Uh-huh. Texas Chainsaw Massacre, Norman Bates' character in Psycho, and also Silence of the Lamb.
I didn't know he was the inspiration for all those.
Yeah.
I knew it was the Texas Chainsaw Massacre.
Yeah, they only charged him with 2 murders that he killed these women, and he took their skin and made things around the house.
Yeah. You know,
and stuff like that. But they also, he had been digging up dead bodies and using that. So he had, it was like parts of 84 different bodies in his house that he had used to make household things like lampshades and drawstrings for shades. And
That's pretty creepy.
Yeah, all kinds of weird stuff. But anyway, so he got hit in the head too. Carlton Gary, aged 8 years old. Gary, who suffered from ill health owing to malnutrition, was knocked unconscious in a playground accident, probably a swing, but the details are unspecified.
Could have been a merry-go-round. We're not certain.
Ian Brady, the Moore's murderer. At the age of 10, Brady was playing with a balloon in the kitchen when he slipped on spilled water, as his adoptive mother was peeling potatoes, and broke his leg. Although there's no reference to a head injury, his leg healed and wouldn't cause him any pain or injury. It is uncertain whether this affected his personality. So they're assuming because he slipped and broke his leg, he probably hit his head.
That's probably the weakest one yet.
Yeah, that is. Gary Hednick, age 6. Hednick fell out of a tree whilst playing, and although his injuries are unspecified, the fall resulted in his skull being oddly shaped, for which he was mercilessly teased by other children.
What was his name?
Gary Hednick, H-E-I-D-N-E-K.
Look at the Hednick.
He doesn't have a good title.
Look at the head on Hednick.
No wonder he got teased. He had an odd-shaped head.
I made that up just now.
Have you seen old Hednick? He's got the oddest-shaped head I've ever seen. Hednick, get over here. What's happened to your head?
He's got a head like a cabbage.
Charles Whitman, the Texas Tower sniper. Although not injured in an accident, Whitman, who murdered 17 people and injured 31 in a shooting spree, during his autopsy was found to have a pecan-sized tumor inside his brain. Alexander Pushishkin, the chessboard killer.
Cheeseboard.
Different between a cheeseboard and a chessboard.
Did you care to come over for some charcuterie?
You're the main course. The chessboard killer. Although initially he was a sociable child, Pushishkin's personality changed when he fell backwards off a swing, which struck him in the forehead as it swung back. Boy, that's like a Three Stooges movie.
Yeah.
He fell off the back and hit his head, and when he sat up, it hit him in the forehead. So it said it struck him in the forehead, it swung back, damaging his frontal cortex, which can produce poor impulse regulation and aggression. Robert Joe Long, Bobby Joe Long, mm-hmm. the classified ad rapist, suffered serious head injuries that we talked about. Peter Sutcliffe, the Yorkshire Ripper. Sutcliffe was born 5 days premature and was starved of oxygen at birth, which resulted in him being incubated for the first 10 days, fighting for his life. That's a little stretch, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, did a nurse hit him on the head during that time? Or?
Well, I guess they're just saying because his brain was starved for oxygen that caused that. Arthur Shawcross, the Genesee River Killer. Shawcross suffered 2 relatively serious head injuries during his early years. Age 16 years old, he was hit in the head with a sports discus. He was the discus catcher, I guess.
Discus catcher?
Yeah. It hit him in the head.
Better
than the javelin catcher.
That's the next worst job on track and field. Javelin catcher is the worst.
And at age 20, he fell off a ladder, hitting his head and concussing himself. Let's see. We got 2 more. Henry Lee Lucas, the highway stalker. I've seen plenty of things about him. He was a weird-looking dude. Lucas claims to have received numerous head injuries between the ages of 5 and 10. The most significant was when, age 7, his mother hit him across the back of the head using a 2x4.
Wow.
The injury resulted in a 3-day coma and caused significant damage to the prefrontal lobe of this killer. And the last one I've got here is Dennis Rader, the BTK killer.
Mm-hmm.
In his recent release biography, Confession of a Serial Killer, he stated that as an infant, his mother had accidentally dropped him on his head. He had stopped breathing and turned blue, but she did not take him to the hospital.
Does he remember this?
That or his mother confessed to him. But, you know, we've all been dropped on our head at some point or another by our mother, haven't we?
Yeah.
I'm pretty sure I remember that.
I think all children have childhood injuries, so that's probably the common theme from that.
Well, he said that, interestingly, Ted Bundy's, after his execution, his brain was removed during the autopsy and was x-rayed, but showed no evidence of injury or abnormality. It's worth noting that there was a fascinating piece in the Washington Post which claimed that serial killers are more likely to have suffered from head trauma as a child or even autism. Criminologist Dr. Adrian Raine scanned the brains of 40-plus convicted killers and compared them to, air quotes, ordinary people, and he found that serial killers have lower activity in the prefrontal area of the brain. This is the area that controls aggression, concentration, and regulates impulse control. Psychopaths also have shrunken amygdala. I need Sydney here to say this.
Medulla oblongata?
Amygdala.
Mm.
The seat of the brain that controls emotion, which explains their lack of empathy, remorse, or guilt when they hurt others.
Hmm.
For some people, the only way to explain serial murders is to say that serial killers are insane. Some serial killers do plead not guilty by reason of insanity as a defense, but are all of them insane or even mentally ill? According to the U.S. Code, an insanity defense means that at the time of the commission of the acts constituting the offense, the defendant, as a result of a severe mental disease or defect, was unable to appreciate the nature and quality or the wrongfulness of his acts. Mental disease or defect does not otherwise constitute a defense. And they say it's extremely hard to prove that someone didn't know right from wrong. You know, and that just because they did it in a crazy way, that doesn't mean that they're insane. They still knew whether they did or not.
Right. Yeah, I mean, obviously, if just doing something really crazy or horrible mm-hmm. was enough, then all these people would be using the insanity defense just based upon their actions alone.
Right. And in the reading of that, they said there were only two people that two serial killers that have ever successfully used insanity defense to be found not guilty due to reason of insanity.
Who's that?
One of them was Ed Gein that we talked about. Mm-hmm. He was found that he was found insane, but they put him in a mental institution for life.
Yeah.
And he never got out.
Good.
As a matter of fact, after he had been in there 11 years, a lawyer did get him to get to another trial to see if he was ready to be let out, and they put him back.
Yeah.
So he never did get out. The other one, which I don't really agree with this as a serial killer, but she's gone down in history as a serial killer, was Andrea Yates. And she was that mother that suffered from postpartum depression and went crazy and drowned her 5 children.
Oh, in the car?
No, drowned them in the bathtub.
Oh, yeah.
Took them in and drowned them in the bathtub. And they're calling her a serial killer. And I don't think that quite comes under the same.
Yeah.
But they found her not guilty by reason of insanity and put her in a mental institution for life.
Yeah, that, I agree with you. That's a bit of a stretch.
Yeah, but that's the only two serial killers. Now, there was one other, that one that I told you about before, Albert Fish, the mm-hmm. werewolf of Wexick or whatever it was, mm-hmm. wherever it was. This was 1936. The jury, upon deliberation, they felt he was insane. But they also felt we'd all be better off if he was dead.
Yeah.
So they found him guilty and executed him. But they did say, yes, he is insane.
We agree. He is crazy. But
we want him dead anyway, so they found him guilty.
That's scary.
Well, it's scarier to keep him alive. This guy was killing kids, and he really had no remorse about it. And he that was his plan. That was his mission in life.
Well, that's going to bring us to
Legal Briefs.
So Legal Briefs is a part of the show where I ask Tommy different questions from the content of the day.
All right.
And the first question is, what does BOLO stand for?
Be on the lookout.
Right. It's the
cousin, APB.
The cousin of APB.
All Points Bulletin.
Now, whenever there was a confession that came in this case we talked about today.
Right.
And the attorney, his defense attorney, wanted to try to keep it out. What did that attorney do?
Filed a suppression notice or motion.
Yeah, motion to suppress.
Yeah.
And then basically what that is there is going to be a hearing. This is not in front of a jury or anything like that. This is all done pre-trial.
In front of the judge.
And just in front of the judge, and they make arguments, and there actually will be some testimony, like I read. The officer will say, kind of run down what took place, and the judge will make a determination about whether or not that evidence is going to be allowed to come in.
Okay.
So, what constitutional amendment does Miranda apply to?
The Fifth.
That's right. Under the Fifth Amendment.
Due process.
Well, it's the right to counsel under the Fifth Amendment. But there is also due process under the Fifth Amendment as well. And it's also kind of runs hand in hand with the Sixth Amendment, which is the right to effective assistance of counsel, but that's only during the actual criminal prosecution itself. So when you're talking about custodial type situations, it's always going to be Fifth Amendment and Miranda.
And also, you don't have to incriminate yourself.
That's true. What is a bifurcated trial?
That's one that includes other crimes that you've committed.
Oh, really?
They can bring them up.
No.
Oh.
A bifurcated trial is where the trial is divided into two different stages. You have your guilt stage and your penalty stage.
Oh, I flunked that one.
Yeah, you just missed that one.
I fluffed that one.
I can't even talk you into getting that one right.
No, I was way off on that.
Now, what you're talking about is 404B evidence, which in Florida is called Williams Rule evidence.
Yeah, that's what I was confused with.
Yeah, and basically that is what is used to show motive, intent, knowledge. And if you actually can get it in the case in chief during the guilt phase, if you win that hearing, otherwise it would only come in during the penalty phase, the second part of the bifurcated trial you were talking about. It almost always comes in there because it's always germane to that. When you're figuring out what penalty for somebody, you always want to know what they've done before. But the fear is that if you put that on during their main case in chief, during the actual guilt phase, that the jury might convict them from their past actions, not actually for what they're accused of right now. So usually
you can't enter that into evidence.
No, you can't. Usually you can't. But if it's like somebody does something always the same way, or they have a history of doing this over and over, you can use that as evidence to basically show that on the certain day of this crime that they probably acted in that way. So that's the difference. And the last question, what is a custodial interrogation and what is its significance?
That's when you bring somebody in to interrogate them, and you must give them their Miranda rights whenever you take them into custodial interrogation.
That's right. It doesn't necessarily have to be an arrest. It's just when they're basically no longer free to leave.
Right.
That's when Miranda attaches. Well, that's pretty good. I think that was like the 85 or 90%.
Yeah, that was a long one. You gave me a lot of questions on that one.
Yeah, I caught my second wind.
I thought I was going to get an essay question there for a minute.
Compare and contrast the duality of mankind.
Oh, man, I'd be lost then. There's those that are in jail and those that aren't.
Yeah. Sure.
Haven't been caught yet.
There's two kinds of criminals. Those in jail and those that haven't been caught.
That's right.
Sure, that sounds good enough to me.
That's about as far as I could go with that. But, you know, I've always joked that the reason I wear my hair long is because I've hit my head so many times. I got a real lumpy head, so I couldn't be one of those guys that shaves his head and looks good with a shaved head. My head would be so lumpy, I'd be one of those ones, they'd stare at me like old Hednick or whatever it was. Have you seen Hednick's head? That's what they'd say to me.
Well, you know, you think about people suffering head injuries and things like that and saying that they shouldn't be held accountable. I mean, I've hit my head a good amount of times. I mean, I was a soccer goalkeeper. I stopped about as many balls with my face as I did with my hands.
You better clarify. Don't just make that statement. Also, you stopped as many balls with your face as you have with your hands.
Well, maybe.
What are you admitting to?
Maybe half as many. Thanks to everybody for listening, and thanks to MCRB for use of their song, Dr. Lawyer Indian Chief.
We're proud to be coming to you almost live from Smurl Studios, high atop Three Last Mountain.
And we want to thank Audio Boom for being a part of their network.
And we also want to thank the McElroy Stable of Podcasts for helping give us our start. Their podcasts include Mabim Bam, Sawbones, Still Buffering, and many other fine offerings.
If you have the chance, take the time to rate and review us on iTunes, especially if you like us. And if you didn't, don't bother.
You're not supposed to say that.
You're going to edit that out though, aren't you?
Why? You never did.
Thanks for listening. This has been Court Appointed. I'm your co-host, Mike Meadows. I'm a lawyer and a dude.
And I'm your other co-host, Tommy Smurl. And I am just a dude.